Well, let me say thank you for the invitation to be here. You brethren are very gullible. I don't know how many years I've been coming back, although I've decided that y'all are bad luck. 5 years ago, I was scheduled to be here. I believe it was June 20. June 12, I had a heart attack. So I called Alan from the hospital, and I said, Alan, I don't think I'm going to make it next Wednesday. And he sounded a little perturbed with me. And he said, and why not? I said, well, I'm in the hospital. I've had a heart attack. He said, oh, well, you're excused. So 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks, 2 weeks ago yesterday, I had two more stents put in. And they thought my first two stents were plugged up. The doctor said, we'll go in, we can clean them out, you know, if we have to replace them, whatever. So, you know, they put me in to go through, and I wake up, and he says, well, good news is nothing wrong with your old stents. Bad news is you had to have two more on the other side. So I told Joanne I'm going to collect the whole set. But it is good to be here, good to be able to be up and out. And I don't know if you remember last year we were here. Jeff and Melinda are here again. But we got here, and it was storming. Remember, about midway through the class, everybody's phone and cell phones and all started beeping the weather warnings, and it was quite chaotic with the winds and the rain, but we made it through, but it is good to be here. By the way, you may have heard, you may already know this, but the Pope has a huge armored limousine that he travels in, and he has a chauffeur, and the Pope would go around making the same speech week after week, month after month. One day they were traveling, and the chauffeur said, you know, sir, said, I've heard this speech so many times, I could deliver it myself. A few minutes later, the Pope said, well, you know, I've always wanted to drive one of these big cars. Let's just switch outfits, and you can make my speech, and I'll drive a car. So they pull over, and the driver puts on the Pope's cassock, and the Pope puts on the driver, the limousine driver's hat and coat and everything, and they go on to this big auditorium, and sure enough, the chauffeur gets up and he delivers the Pope's speech word for word. The Pope's standing in the back smiling, watching. Well, unbeknownst to either of them, the MC gets up and said, now we're going to open the floor to questions. And the first question was a very deep philosophical question about the Bible. And the chauffeur is just floored. He doesn't know what to say. And finally he says, you know, that's the dumbest question I ever heard. So that question is so dumb, I'm going to let my chauffeur answer it. So, sometimes that's what you have to do, Alan. You know, this topic was a puzzler. I think Alan sits around and just says, what difficult topics can I come up with? And I decided there were several ways I could go, and I hope that this one will be satisfactory. But I want to begin by stating a very obvious fact. Looking around here, most of you are my age or maybe a little older, Jennings. Brother Rogers. There's a couple of you here older, and of course Dana got me by a couple of years, I think. But things have changed since we were in school. Anybody notice that besides me? Things have changed dramatically. You know, we would have fights in school, boys would have fights, but nobody ever took out a gun and shot the other one. Usually within a week or so of a fight, the guys were best buddies again, and all was forgotten. And along with that, if I got in trouble at school and got a paddling, guess what happened when I got home? I got another one. So I never went home and complained that the teacher paddled me. I kept my mouth shut and hoped my brother didn't tell. No one's dad ever went to school and punched out a teacher for disciplining his son. We were all taught history from a historical standpoint, not some twisted historical view that denies or distorts world events such as Pearl Harbor, the Holocaust, or other things, because we might offend someone. We don't want to be politically incorrect. And shock of shock, boys never used the girls' bathroom. If we'd tried, back to the paddling. And girls certainly never wanted to go in the boys' bathroom because it stunk and it was usually nasty. Boys were boys and girls were girls, and nobody tried to cross over. We were content where we were. But you know, one of the biggest changes, I know, Alan, I'm getting where you told me. Perhaps one of the greatest changes we've witnessed is in the realm of newscasting. I can remember when newscasters and reporters were respected. They were held up as somewhat of a hero. If something was reported on the news, you could count on it being true. And if it turned out to be false a day or two later, guess what? They would go on the air and they would acknowledge that mistake and they would correct it. Now today, they would try to explain it away. But in our day, they would acknowledge it. You know, newscasters in our day reported the news. They didn't try to twist. They didn't try to make the news. They didn't try to distort the news to fit their political agenda. They didn't attempt to cover up and hide things. They simply told the news as it was. How many of you can remember Chet Huntley and David Brinkley? I can remember as a boy watching the black and white TV. I was a teenager before we got color TV, and I thought we were rich. And when we got cable, man, that was just off the charts. But I can remember watching that little black and white TV with Chet Huntley and David Brinkley, and I can still remember their closing words, "Good night, Chet." "Good night, David." And they would sign off. And to this day, I still remember their newscast, and I can remember those grainy black and white reels, they call them, of the Vietnam War that they would show. Why those things stick in my mind, I don't know. And who can forget the name of Walter Cronkite, a CBS newscaster for some 20 years? There was a time when he was known as the most trusted man in America. I looked that up to make sure that Alan hadn't led me astray. I looked that up on Google and read about it, but he was known as the most trusted man in America. When was the last time you heard those words applied to a newscaster today? And you probably never will. Frankly, I don't trust the main, and I don't mean to be offensive, but I don't trust the mainstream media. If they tell me the sun's coming up in the east tomorrow, I want to be out there to watch, to make sure, because they have an agenda. They're not honest with us. And if I really want to know what's going on, if I want to know the truth, I don't turn on ABC, NBC, CBS, and I'm not going to name all of them all, but you know, you get my gist. There are other sources to go for the news that are far more trustworthy. In fact, as I was thinking about this, I thought, well, I wonder what percentage of Americans have any confidence in our news system. And this is from a 2022 Gallup poll. You can go online and check it out for yourself if you like. But according to this 2022 Gallup poll, only 7% of Americans have a great deal of confidence and trust in the media. 27% of Americans have a fair amount of confidence in the mainstream media. 38% have no confidence at all in newspapers, TV, and radio. And the article I was reading on this said this is the first time that the percentage of Americans with no trust at all in the media is higher than the percentage with a great deal or a fair amount combined. Now, at first, we want to laugh and smile. Yeah, I understand it. But that's a sad commentary on our society, isn't it? That we can't go to the very people who are supposed to be giving us the truth and get the truth. We get a distorted truth. We get a partial truth, or we get an outright denial of things. And so the question is, who can we trust? Now, we're not going to go into who you can trust to get the latest news and political views and things like that. But from a spiritual standpoint, spiritual truths, who can we trust? Who can we trust when it comes to what do I need to do to be saved? How do I need to worship God? How does God want me to live the Christian life? And the sad reality is that there's so many sources out there in the world today that you can turn to. And for example, I was brought up in a Christian family, so I have that advantage. Some of you were not. And I've actually had people say to me, "I don't know where to turn. I don't know where to look." We've had a young woman attending our services up at Vermilion, and her story is quite simple. She decided she wanted to be religious. You know, she was getting spiritual concerns. And she said, "I went to the Catholic Church," and she said, "that just wasn't good." She said, "So I went to a Pentecostal church." And with a little bit of sarcasm, she said, "I don't want any more speaking in tongues, and I don't want any more laying on of hands." She said, "And if that's what y'all do, I'm not interested." I said, "Nope, we don't." And she's been coming now for 4 or 5 weeks. She's doing Bible studies online from World Video Bible School, and she's talking about obeying the gospel, and that she wants to study more. But here's a girl that didn't know where to turn. She didn't know where to look for spiritual guidance and spiritual truth. And everybody's got a source, right? My mama says, or my grandma told me, my preacher told me, or I read on the internet. Now that's the real go-getter. There's so many ways to turn, but again, who can we trust? If you really want to know how to be saved, and for those of us in the church, you know, maybe it's hard for us to grasp the idea that there's a lot of confusion. People look around and there are literally thousands of denominations and they're all teaching different doctrines. Not only do they conflict with one another, but most of these denominations have conflicts with the Bible in many respects. Now, obviously, most denominations do teach some truth. I wouldn't deny that. But I'm talking about preaching the whole counsel of God. So again, where do we turn? I want to look at several of the places that people turn today and see just how reliable they are, how believable they are. And I want to emphasize the importance of this question. You know, when it comes to buying a car or a truck, we all have our opinions, right? I'm a Dodge man. I've driven Dodges for years. I love Dodges. Mopar all the way. And that doesn't work real well in Vermilion because there are two Ford plants up there. Most of my members have been or are Ford employees and drive Ford trucks, which I must say, you know, 80% of the Fords sold in the last 10 years are still on the road. The other 20% made it home. Now see, when I told that at home, they didn't laugh. They didn't think that was funny. But you know, it doesn't matter whether you drive a Ford, a Chevy, or a foreign import, because that's not going to affect your eternal destiny. The kind of clothes you buy, the brand, you know, maybe you like Walmart jeans. They're cheap. That's what I go for. Or maybe you want the name brand. Doesn't matter. There are a lot of things in life that really don't affect us. Maybe a few months or a year. But what we're talking about tonight are things of eternity. Things of eternal value. The eternal destiny of your soul depends upon where you look. And secondly, how you respond to the information that you get. You know, we've got to make sure we're right, brother, even in the church. Because sometimes I think Christians have this idea, well, I'm a member of the church, you know, I don't have to question anything, right? But let's face it, some things have crept into the Lord's church in the last 10, 20, and I know, Dana, you've seen these things in your years of preaching, and Brother Rogers, we've all witnessed these changes that are coming about, and not all change is bad, don't get me wrong. But there have been a lot of doctrinal changes, a lot of compromise in regard to truth, and we're seeing churches departing, if you will. Everything from changing their names. We've got a congregation about 10 minutes down the road from us. They used to be known as the Amherst Church of Christ. Well, now they are the New Beginnings Church. They don't even identify themselves as a congregation of the Lord's people. And so we've got to watch for change. But again, going back to the original idea, we've got to be sure that we're right in what we're doing, not only in obeying the gospel, but in living the Christian life, worshiping God. Everything we do, we need to make it as sure as we can. You know, Davy Crockett is credited with saying, make sure you're right, and then go ahead. Now, whether he actually said that or not, I don't know, but he's credited with saying those words, and if he didn't, it's still a good philosophy to follow. But I want to look at some of the places that people turn for salvation, for truth, in our society today. And certainly, we're not going to have the time to look at all of them. I can take several hours and still not do justice to the topic. But, you know, there are a lot of people in our nation today and perhaps other parts of the world that want to turn to the Old Testament for truth and salvation. Specifically, they want to turn to the Ten Commandments. How many of you have ever had a friend, a neighbor, a relative in discussing salvation say something to the effect, well, I think if you just live a good life and follow the Ten Commandments, you can go to heaven. Anybody else hear that besides me? Yeah. A lot of people have that idea. The Ten Commandments, that's all we need to be saved and to go to heaven. Now, I don't know of anyone who would deny that the Ten Commandments are a good moral code, that they contain and set forth a lot of good principles, a lot of truth. But what most people don't realize is that the Ten Commandments are only a synopsis, if you will, of the entirety of God's law given to Moses. There were many laws and regulations given in addition to the Ten Commandments that the Israelites were to follow. The Ten Commandments are not what we need for truth. The Ten Commandments say nothing about going to heaven or what to do to be saved. And when people talk about this, obviously they haven't studied the Scriptures, because they should know that the Ten Commandments were given to who? The Israelites, the Hebrews, the Jews, whatever you want to call them. They were given to God's covenant people in the Old Testament. You remember in Deuteronomy chapter 5 and verse 3, Moses is giving, he's repeating the Ten Commandments to the people. He's giving them for the second time to the people. And he emphasized that those laws were not given to their fathers, or, as he says, with anyone else, but with us, with all those of us alive here today. The Ten Commandments were not given to the people prior to the nation of Israel. They were not given for us today. It was a covenant between God and His people in the Old Testament. And the covenant is agreement between two parties, two groups, or two individuals. It doesn't apply to outsiders. It doesn't apply to other people. It applies to the parties of the covenant. And so the Ten Commandments were a covenant between God and the Jews, and it did not apply to anyone else. And it certainly doesn't apply to us today. And you know, something else, those who go to the Old Testament searching for truth and salvation, they fail to realize that the Ten Commandments were only a temporary law. They were not given for perpetuity. It was a temporary law. It was to be replaced. It was to be done away with. In fact, if you look in Jeremiah chapter 31, and remember, the Ten Commandments were still in effect when Jeremiah prophesied to God's people. And Jeremiah said what? God is going to make a new covenant with His people. If you want to follow along in Jeremiah 31, beginning in verse 31, he said, "Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. Not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, which my covenant they break, although I was a husband unto them, saith the Lord. But this shall be the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel. After those days, saith the Lord, I will put my law in their inward parts and write it in their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. And they shall teach no more every man his neighbor and every man his brother, saying, Know the Lord. For they shall all know me, from the least of them unto the greatest of them, saith the Lord. For I will forgive their iniquity, and I will remember their sin no more." Notice, God says they didn't keep that covenant. They broke that covenant. But He was going to make, as verse 31 says, a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. What was that new covenant? Did Jeremiah know what it was? No indication that he did. But what was that new covenant? Anybody? Dana? What was the new covenant Jeremiah prophesied? The New Testament, the law of Christ, which was not for the Jews, was not for the Gentiles, but it was for all men, as Jesus teaches in the Great Commission, Matthew 28, 18 through 20. All nations, all people would be amenable to this law. In fact, if you look at Hebrews 9 and verse 15, "For this reason He," that is Jesus, "He is the mediator of a new covenant, so that since a death has taken place for the redemption of the transgressors that were committed under, transgressions that were committed under the first covenant, those who have been called may receive the promise of the eternal inheritance." Notice, Jesus is the mediator of a new covenant. And as the Hebrew writer says, there's a change of the priesthood. He said there must also be a change of the law. Think about it. Jesus could not be our high priest under the law of Moses. Why? Okay, but you're right, but what else? As far as the priesthood, though. Exactly. Under the law of Moses, only the Levites, specifically the descendants of Aaron, could be the priest. But Jesus was not of the tribe of Levi. What tribe was he of? Judah. He could not have been our high priest if the law of Moses is still in effect today and is still binding today. We would need a Levitical priest, a descendant of Aaron. But Jesus is our high priest. I don't know anybody who would deny that. Why can he be? Because it's a new covenant. The law of Moses is no longer in effect. Hebrews 12:24 speaks of Jesus, the mediator of the new covenant. And if you look in the Hebrews letter, chapter 8, beginning in verse 7, the writer there refers back to Jeremiah's prophecy. And he says, "For if that first covenant had been faultless," that is the law of Moses, "if that first covenant had been faultless, then should no place have been sought for the second." Now stop and let that sink in. The first covenant was faultless, he says. If it hadn't been, there would have been no reason to have a second covenant. We wouldn't have needed a new covenant. We could have just still been under the law of Moses. Beginning in verse 8, "For finding fault with them," he saith, "behold, the days come, saith the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day when I took them by the hand to lead them out of the land of Egypt, because they continued not in my covenant." And we're not going to continue reading that, but notice, the fact remains, he begins there, the first covenant was faulted. It was not perfect. Now, it served its purpose, and its purpose was what? To bring us to Christ, to bring us to Christ's new covenant, new law, exactly. And so it served its purpose. We're not bad-mouthing the old law. We're not saying that it was bad or that it was imperfect, only in the sense that it could not provide redemption. But it did do what God intended for it to do, and that was to bring us to Christ. You know, among the other things, as we look at the Old Testament, with the coming of that new covenant that Jeremiah speaks of there, he says there's going to be a new name. Not Jeremiah, but Isaiah is the one that says it. "And the Gentiles shall see thy righteousness and all kings thy glory, and thou shalt be called by a new name, which the mouth of the Lord shall name." Now, Isaiah, what's that new name? He didn't know. He doesn't give it. We're not told a new name in the Old Testament. In fact, that new name doesn't come along until when? What? Actually, the name came after Pentecost. Because after Pentecost, they were called believers. They were called disciples. But anybody remember? Antioch, Acts 11:26. The disciples were called Christians first at Antioch. And you know what amazes me? How many writers today, even some New Testament Christians, will say, well, that's not the name. The name Christian was given in derision by their enemies. You know, it wasn't a God-given name. Well, just suppose for a moment that's true. Suppose Christian is not that God-given name that Isaiah talked about. What is the name? Has it been given yet? And if so, what is that name? Now, their enemies may have used that name, but this was the name God gave to His people, Christian. And that name has stuck for some 2,000 years to the followers of Christ. Now, they weren't called by this name under the old law. They were called Israel. They were called Israelites. They were called Hebrews. And it wasn't until in the captivity that the name Jew began to be used. You know, we sometimes use that term Jew incorrectly because for many, many years, the Israelites were not known as Jews. But rather that name came from the name Judah, from the tribe of Judah. You know, few people today, at least in the denominational world, realize that the old law has been taken out of the way. It's been invalidated. You know, in the early days of our nation, what law were we under? And I'm going all the way back, pre-1776. What? No, even before that. I'm talking about pre-1776. We were under British law, right? Okay, but then we became a nation, and what did we do with the British law? It threw it over the boat with the tea bags, right? We got rid of that law. Now, why? Why didn't we keep British law and American law? Okay, but you can't be under two laws, right? It's just like, you can't, you know, you go into court, you're under U.S. law. You can't say, but the British law says, and the judge goes, who cares? This isn't Britain. You can't be under the law of Moses and the law of Christ. They're totally opposites. If you look at 2 Corinthians 3 and verse 7 and 8 and then verse 11, he says, but if the ministration of death written and engraved in stones was glorious, so that the children of Israel could not steadfastly behold the face of Moses for the glory of his countenance. Remember when he came out of the tabernacle, being in the presence of God, he came out and his face just glowed, and the people couldn't look at him, and they told him to put a veil on his face. And he would do that. He would cover his face so the people could look at him, and then he would take the veil off when he would go back in. That's what this is talking about. They could not steadfastly behold the face of Moses for the glory of his countenance, which glory was to be done away. How shall not the ministration of the Spirit be rather glorious? For if that which is done away was glorious, what was that which is done away? Well, in the context, talking about the law of Moses, much more that which remaineth is glorious. That which was done away was the Ten Commandments and the law of Moses. That which remains is what? It's the gospel of Christ, the new covenant. You know, Paul says that which was written on stone, and obviously that's a reference to the Ten Commandments, but that which was written on stone has been done away, while the ministration of the Spirit remains. And the law of Christ will remain until the end of time when the Lord returns. There will be no latter-day revelation, as Joseph Smith and the Mormons would have us to believe, and some others. We have God's final, complete revelation to man. And of course, I know you're familiar with Colossians 2 and verse 14, blotting out the handwriting of ordinances that was against us, which was contrary to us, and took it out of the way, nailing it to the cross. Now, of course, if you talk to some of the Sabbatarians today and those who believe that we're under the old law, they will tell you, oh, well, this is talking about the ceremonial law, not the moral law. Well, when you get a chance, I want you to find that. You find that distinction between the ceremonial law and the moral law and show it to me in Scripture. This is something man has come up with, not God. You see, the cross of Christ marks the end of the Old Testament law as a law, and it brings in a new dispensation. It wasn't until Acts 2 on Pentecost that we find the gospel of Jesus Christ, repentance, confession, baptism for the remission of sin, the church. We find all of these things being preached for the very first time. Why? Because it's a new law. It's a new dispensation, a new covenant. Somebody says, but wait a minute, preacher. You mean if the old law is done away with, it's okay to steal, it's okay to lie, it's okay to murder, to commit adultery? No. People don't understand that we don't keep these commands. We don't refrain from murder and stealing and adultery because the Old Testament law made that, well, since it made it a law, made it wrong. It's wrong to murder. Why? Okay, but more specifically. Okay. It's wrong because the New Testament condemns it. It's wrong to commit adultery because the New Testament, not because Moses said don't do it in the Old Testament. But you see, 9 out of the 10 commandments have been brought over into the law of Christ. That's why we don't do these things. Not because the 10 commandments said it, forbade it, but because Christ forbade it. You know, these things that are repeated in the New Testament, they're not listed together, you know, number 1, number 2, number 3, number 4 through 10. That's not the way they're given. But they are given, and they're given with a lot more information. Not only are we not to murder, but as Sister Sleen said a moment ago, we're not to hate. You know, we're not only to not hate, we're to love our enemies. Not only are we forbidden from committing adultery, we're told not even to lust, not even to have adultery in our minds or in our hearts. And so those 9 of the 10 commandments that have carried over into the new covenant, they have been expounded upon greatly by Christ. Now, you say, well, what's all this got to do with our topic? Simply this, the Old Testament is not a reliable source to find, now listen carefully, don't go out of here and say, I said the Old Testament was not reliable. It's not a reliable source for how to get to heaven. It's not a reliable source as to how to worship God. It's not a reliable source as far as how God wants us to live our daily lives. Now, it's reliable as far as telling us how God dealt with those people. It's reliable about the historical content that we look back and read about the children of Israel. But you see, if we're looking for the truth about salvation, about pleasing God, about going to heaven, about serving Him in worship, we've got to look elsewhere. Now, on the other extreme, and I can't believe, you know, 25, 30 years ago, I've been preaching almost 51 years. And I would have never dreamed I needed to address this, at least in the United States. Now, I've dealt with this in India and other countries. But you would be amazed at how many people are turning to the Quran for how to be saved. You realize that the Muslim religion is the fastest growing religion in the world? Do you realize that the Muslim religion is the fastest growing religion in the United States today? They're even smoking the Mormons. You know, for years, the Mormons were the fastest growing religious group in America. Islam is growing by leaps and bounds. You're finding mosques springing up all over America. Even in Atlanta, Georgia, the conservative South now has a Muslim mosque. Young people are the primary converts. And if I could digress for just a moment, I'll tell you my opinion why I think a lot of our young people are looking to religions like the Muslim religion and others that could be mentioned, Hinduism, Buddhism. It's because they have seen all of the division in the so-called Christian world. They've seen and they've heard denominational preachers arguing and contradicting one another, preaching totally different doctrines on what to do, what not to do. And basically, they're fed up with it. They're turned off to Christianity. And I've said it before, and I'll say it probably till I draw my last breath. Denominationalism is one of the greatest causes of infidelity in the world today. Because people, especially young people, they listen to this preacher. You be saved by faith only. And this one says, no, you're saved by works. And this one says, you're saved by grace only. And on the various answers go. And they say, if these preachers can't agree, how am I supposed to know what to do? And they walk away in disgust. I don't need any of that. And they start looking to religions such as Islam, Hinduism, and others. It is sad because when you start looking at the Muslim religion, and I don't mean this to be ugly and I don't mean this to be sarcastic, but it's a joke as far as being a serious attempt at worshiping God. First of all, because, well, I guess I'll back up and give you a little bit of information. You may be aware that a man by the name of Muhammad, who was born in Mecca in 570 AD, is the founder of the Muslim religion. Think about it. He was a man who was born 500 years after the birth of Christ. And he claims to have revelations. Well, right there we have to question. Because what does Jude 3 say? Contend earnestly for the faith, which is one time for all time delivered unto the saints. That is the final revelation, is it not? The New Testament. And so when anybody comes along, whether it's 500 years later or 1800 years later, as in the case of Joseph Smith, and they say, oh, I've got a final revelation. I've got God's latest revelation on what you need to do, how to be saved, and what to do to worship God. No, right there, that ought to be a red flag for us. And do you remember what Paul told the Galatians in Galatians 1, 8, and 9? Now, that's one you ought to remember. If any man preaches any other gospel unto you than that which I have preached, what? Let him be accursed. Or the American Standard says, let him be anathema. And then he says the same thing again, as though for emphasis there. If any man preaches, even if an angel preaches unto you, any other gospel, don't listen to him. And yet multitudes of people are turning to Muhammad. Now, Muhammad was a strange bird. And I got to be careful how I word this, because I got to go home with my wife, and there's several other wives here that might take this wrong. Muhammad married a rather wealthy older widow. She was, I think, 30 years older than him. But you know, money can blind a lot of things. So he marries this wealthy woman by the name of Khadijah. But after he got married, he started spending a lot of time in this cave at Mount Hira, in which he claims to have been visited by the angel Gabriel. Now, his spending all this time in the cave, I'm not sure if that says more about his spirituality or about his marital situation living with Khadijah. I don't know. I'll leave that up to you. But he claims that during these visits in the cave, the angel Gabriel came and he gave him all of these revelations from God. In fact, these revelations, he said, went on for some 23 years. These revelations by God. And ironically, these revelations were only repeated orally. They were never written down until many years later. Some of his followers, some of his friends begin to write these things down. And when they finished writing all these things he had supposedly said, they had this book called Al-Quran, which was shortened simply to the Quran, at least in English. And if you were to summarize the essence of Muhammad's teaching, the thing he talked about most of all was polytheism. You see, the people of his day were polytheistic. They had many, many gods. And each tribe had their own god. Well, Muhammad had had a lot of contact with Jewish Arabians. And he talked to them about religious matters. And this is generally believed where he got the idea of there only being one god. And he was right. There is only one God, one Jehovah. And he began to press this upon his fellow Arabians in that area. And this created some friction. And thus they began to fight. And he gathered an army and he began to fight back. And over time, the Islamic religion became a very violent, a very warlike group. And even today, if you read the Quran, you'll find that one of the tenets of Islam is kill the infidel. Well, I hate to break it to you, but you know who the infidels are? Us. We're the infidels. Now, I know, Mr. Obama told us, however many years ago, Islam is a peaceful religion. Well, Mr. Obama was either grossly ignorant or a bald-faced liar. I'm not going to say which, because it doesn't take a lot of education to read the Quran and see that it is not a peaceful religion. Its growth has come at the price of blood. They would go in and conquer a city or a town. And they would line the men up and they would say, do you wish to convert to Islam? And if they said no, they cut off their heads. Well, after the first five or six of these, the people called on, yes, we want to convert. And people wonder how they grew by leaps and bounds. Those that killed anyone who didn't want to convert. And we don't have time to go into all of the various tenets of Islam, but let me just suggest to you that the God of Islam is a God of human frailty and a God of human weaknesses. He is not the sovereign creator that we read about in Scripture. You know, Jehovah is a God of love, he's a God of compassion, a God of mercy, and as we look at Allah, we see that he is a temperamental, vicious, revengeful being. And yet I've even had members of the church say, well, you know, we worship the same God. They just call him Allah. Uh-uh. We do not worship. And I'm glad we don't worship Allah, because he's nothing at all like the God that we read about in the Bible. And as we look at the Quran, it's a book of human origins. It talks about killing one's enemies. He talks about all kinds of things, you know, taking another man's wife, a plurality of wives. You realize Muhammad married an 8-year-old girl when his wife died? And if you bring that up to a Muslim, oh, well, he didn't consummate it till she was 9. Big deal. I mean, I'm sorry, maybe I'm just from the conservative South, but 9 years old, he took this girl. And those are some of the better things that we learn about this man. It's a book that's filled with myths. It's a book of legends. It's founded on so many uninspired teachings. And virtually nothing in the Quran can be verified. You know, the Bible has been vindicated. It's been verified over and over from a scientific standpoint, from an archaeological standpoint, from a medical standpoint. So many of the things that the Old Testament taught about health, hygiene, and sanitation, today we understand. And it's accepted as truth. But you don't find any of those things in the Quran as far as proving that it has a divine origin. Not only that, the Quran contradicts the Bible over and over again. It makes statements that cannot be verified, have not been verified, and never will be verified. And yet, when you listen to these people, oh, the Quran is the greatest book. It's a wonderful book. You know, as Christians, or as a Christian, I have no problem with anyone questioning the Bible. I've had young people come to me and say, well, what about this? And I try to give them a biblical answer. But I don't get mad when somebody questions the inspiration of the Bible or what about this alleged contradiction or this alleged discrepancy in Scripture. I try to give them an answer. And if I can't find an answer, I usually can find somebody who can. But you know what happens if you question Muhammad or the Quran? Does anybody remember the name Salman Rushdie? He wrote a book rebuking and condemning Muhammad. A bounty was put on his head, and just here within the last few months, he was attacked and knifed because he dared to question the Prophet Muhammad. Does that sound like a book or an individual that anyone would want to go to searching for spiritual truth? Does that sound like a source that we would want to go to find what to do to be saved or how to live to be pleasing to God? And it saddens me that so many young people are turning, searching to the Quran. You know, for years I taught in the prison system in Southern Illinois. I was a chaplain there and did worship services every Sunday night with 3 other gospel preachers. I would only go one night. But then on Tuesday mornings we would have a Bible study with prisoners. And we had the second largest attendance of all religious groups. Guess who was number one? The Muslims. Not the Baptists, not the Pentecostals, not the Catholics. They were way down the line. We were number 2. We would have 60 and 70 inmates coming in there. But man, the Muslims would have that gymnasium packed. And I couldn't help but wonder, what are they searching for? Why are they looking there? Just very briefly, I thought I'd have more time than this, but a lot of young people today are looking to the Book of Mormon. Mormonism, searching for truth. And I'm sure you've heard the story of Joseph Smith in the Book of Mormon when he was a young boy. He claimed that the angel Moroni appeared to him and told him the location of a bunch of golden plates, and the golden plates contained God's final revelation to man. And furthermore, the angel told him that God wanted him to restore the church because none of the churches, none of the denominations were the true church, and it was up to Joseph Smith to restore Christianity. Well, these golden plates were given to Joseph Smith, and shortly thereafter he translated them with the help, and I'm not making this up, of a peeping stone, a shiny white rock. He would put it in a stovepipe, and I'm not making this up, this is actually from their writings, but he would drop this white rock into a hat like Abraham Lincoln wore, and he would put his face down in there, and the letters would appear in the bottom of the hat. And he would read off the words, and he had a secretary, a young man, who wrote it down. And those words, which he allegedly translated, were what's now known as the Book of Mormon. And the irony is, these plates, these golden plates, were written in an ancient Egyptian language, which nobody knew. But yet Joseph Smith gets an Egyptologist to come and to look at the golden plates and to look at his revelation and to say, it's accurately translated. Now, I am not the sharpest knife in the drawer. But even I can see that. If it's an unknown language, how do you know it's correctly translated? If nobody can speak it, if nobody can write it, if nobody knows the alphabet, if nobody knows what the language is, how can anybody look at that text and then look at his translation and say, yep, it's accurately translated? Now right there, that ought to be a dead giveaway. This is not where you need to be looking. There are just so many things, and we don't have time to look at the three sacred books. Of course, the Book of Mormon is their primary book. The second is the Pearl of Great Price. The third book is the Doctrine of Covenant. And by the way, just for information, and this is from the book Shadow of a Reality by Gerald and Sandra Tanner, ex-Mormons. But the Book of Mormon has undergone over 2,200 changes since its origin, since it first came out. There again, that ought to tell you, is this an inspired book of God to have that much? Not only that, the Book of Mormon is filled with some very absurdities. For example, we read of a prophecy. And that prophecy was written on a scroll. And the scroll, we're told, was the length of a tree. Now, how many of you know the length of a tree? Josh? Yeah, that's the point. What kind of tree? Now, that's absurd. You know, instead of some number, something is the length of a tree. Well, that's kind of a broad number. Not only that, God was telling the prophet how they were going to get from one land to another in this boat. God gives instructions for a boat, and the best description you have is it's a football-shaped boat. And it's going to roll through the water. Just visualize a football rolling like this across the ocean. And the prophet said, Lord, what are we going to do for air? What are we going to do for light? And you know what God told him? He said, drill a hole in the top and drill a hole in the bottom. Lord, what's to keep the water out? Oh, well, you make a wooden plug. And you poke it in the hole on the bottom, and when that one goes to the top, you pull the plug and put it in the bottom. I'm not making this up. I don't have that kind of imagination. And yet people read this, oh yeah, this is from God. I'm sorry, if that's the God that you worship, you're going to have problems. And these are just a couple of examples of the absurdities that are found in the Book of Mormon, and yet countless thousands of people are turning to Mormonism in a search for truth. So, to make a long story short, what is the right place to look? God's Word. Jesus said, John 8:32, ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. Somebody says, and remember Pilate asked Jesus, what is truth? Well, John 17:17 gives you the answer. Sanctify them through thy truth. Thy word is truth. If you're looking for truth, that's all you need. You don't need the Quran. You don't need the Book of Mormon. You don't need, and I was going to mention some other sources and books that people are turning to, but clearly we have everything that we need. As 2 Peter 1 and verse 3 says, according as His divine power hath given unto us all things that pertain unto life and godliness through the knowledge of Him that hath called us to glory and virtue. Now, if the New Testament contains everything we need, what else do we need? Nothing. We have the perfect law of liberty. We need to keep looking in the right source. We need to encourage others to look to the truth. Because we said a moment ago, the truth is the only thing that will set us free. Does anyone have questions or comments? Feel free to ask. If not, you can ask Dana later. I'm sure he'll be able to answer them.